Hello, welcome to the Photo Show. I'm Ian Rankin, professional photographer in Birmingham, and this is the show that comes out from the British Tech Network periodically, and I say periodically because it's got somewhat Greeny-esque in the last few years, it's all about the photo industry. Gear, news, questions from you, that kind of stuff. If you want to follow us, then you can subscribe to us on Twitter, and you can follow us at BritishTechNetwork.com. You can subscribe to us on at British Tech on Twitter, and you can subscribe to us in iTunes as well. And please, 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 now that we're coming back a little bit, I do expect that you're going to want some more shows up before you start really committing to it. But if you could give us some reviews in iTunes, that would boost our position within the rankings, and we'd get more exposure. So please, please, please check us out on iTunes. Right. We're back. We're here for another week. Thanks to Ian Lewis and myself. We've done the document, and it's out there. There are show notes for this show. Would you believe it? And we'll get started straight in then with the news. First bit of news is that Clementine Schneiderman has won the Leica Oscar Barnack Newcomer Award for her photography of the North Wales town of Abertillery up in Gwent. She has moved there since she finished doing her degree in photography at the University of South Wales, and her project is called The Unbearable, The Sadness and The Rest. So here's one of the pictures that she put in her exhibition. It's a picture of a bus stop on a road. I'm not sure I haven't been at that bus stop, if it's near the Slate Mine. It's a picture of a bus stop. There you go. Here's another picture of a girl in the high street. Don't know which part of the Abertillery she's in. Here's another girl. A couple of girls stood. Now, the thing is, she's put down this called The Unbearable, The Sadness and The Rest, because Abertillery is financially pretty badly impinged upon, if you like, by closures of mines and things like that in the area. Industry's nowhere near the same. And I guess she's trying to get over a bit of an economic bleakness more than a landscape bleakness. But the images that she's put out, I get the artistic intent of the fact that she's got a girl in a leopard suit against a pebble dash house, and it blends in and it's quite interesting. But the girl's just stood in front, and I can't remember who it was, but we did have an award given to us, someone who shot really, really depressing shots of children outside an Eastern European dwellings. And this is not particularly different. The thing that bothers me, that's a really nicely composed image that I'm showing there with the girl in the leopard skin against the pebble dash. And I don't have a problem with it, but it's underexposed, and a lot of these are really badly underexposed. And I know, I do get the fact that people are trying to shoot stuff and then make it look like it was shot on old film stock. But this is not the way to do it. You expose properly, and then you apply your effect. Whereas a lot of I don't get the point of what the shot is in some of them. I don't understand what it's trying to show. What's the artistic quality that it's getting over? It says that it's about drawing on modern documentary photography with a modern aesthetic drawn from the pages of fashion magazines and social media. Well, she's grasped the social media in the fact that they're not particularly good shots, but fashion magazine bit, if you worked in a fashion magazine and you produced technical images like this, I'm sorry, you'd be out of a job. For the life of me, I cannot see how this is. I mean, we have got to stop giving awards to people. She's got a stylist with her as well. Charlotte James was her stylist. So these are very structured shots, and she's trying to recreate bad photography, and she's done a great job because some of them are awful shots. Why we give awards to people for stuff that could be shot on a cell phone on any day of the week is beyond me, because it doesn't show anything. It's a depressing set of images. And the other thing that's really sad about the whole project for me is that area of our country is absolutely one of the most beautiful areas that you'll find in the whole of the UK. It's the Snowdonia National Park, and it is stunning. There are some awesome views, there is lovely landscape, there are some very pretty villages there. And she could have done far more for the economics of the region by showing those than by winning an award for that kind of stuff. I'm sorry, Charlotte. You're obviously a talent, Clementine. You're obviously someone who's technically competent, but I'm sorry, I have no idea why you've produced those. Didn't want to start on a downer, but there you go. Let's go up a bit. This is the Air. A-E-R is the way that it's spelt. This is a project that will take your GoPro and let it take flight. A group of Dutch people, it's a Dutch firm, they're running a Kickstarter project that is going to provide this finned GoPro housing for you in February 2017. It's a fairly simple concept. You see there's like a styrofoamy type fin structure, and then there's a 3D printed housing on the front that allows you to hold your GoPro. What's kind of nice about this is it collapses, so you can fold the fins flat and it goes into a bag that you'll get with it if you pay the right amount of money. And you stick your GoPro in it. There's a video which I haven't got any stills for, but you clamp your GoPro in it while it's still in the waterproof housing into the structure, and then basically you put it on burst mode or you just put it on time lapse, and you get it to take a picture a second or a picture every half second, and you chuck it. Simple as that. Or you put it into video mode and you just throw it. The video has got some absolutely stunning bits of footage on and some really inventive ways of using it. I was really impressed. I've only got the stills that were taken, and these are just people throwing it in the air to take selfies and catching it, or throwing it to mates. There's a couple of mates here swimming around in a pool and someone's thrown the thing to them because it's still in the waterproof housing. It doesn't have to worry about it. Doesn't say whether it takes a GoPro 5 or whether there's a GoPro 5 version coming out. But it's a really interesting, I really like that one, the one throwing it up in a circular ring. That's really, really cool. I've ordered it. I could see me using this on a commercial site. You know, if you say to someone, look, I'm going to throw this, I'm going to throw it over there, and it's going to go over the guys that are working and out and past. I don't know. Do you need an arm like a quarterback? Well, that's the question. But I did see a few people throwing it, and it didn't look like they were stunningly good at throwing in terms of you know, like I say, quarterback level NFL. But I liked it. I really liked it a lot. The only thing I'll say is it's a Kickstarter project. There is a set of show notes. Everyone goes, oh, can we have show notes for all the shows at BTN? There is a set of show notes for this show because there's not a lot of posts going into the chat room for you to draw upon at britishtechnetwork.com/chat. So if you look on the post on BTN, just britishtechnetwork.com/photo, go to the relevant post. In there is a download link, and on there will be a PDF that you can download that's got all the links to all the stories, all of the cool things, that kind of stuff, everything that's gone on, and you can follow through as you listen to the show, even if you really want to get it down beforehand. So then, go back to the Air. The Air, I've got to say I was skeptical, because I thought when you throw it, it's going to rotate, but the way that they throw it, they put like two fingers behind it, so you're throwing it with a lot more structure, if you like. And when they showed you it being thrown, there was quite an interesting bit where someone threw it and then someone threw one after the one that had gone off, so the thing moving. It didn't rotate at all. It was very, very stable. I was very impressed. Maybe there's a bit of training to kind of work out how to throw it that stably, but I was impressed. Impressed is impressed. So I went to go for it. The early birds are all gone, of course, the ones that are $34 for the basic, €34 rather, for the basic version. I jumped onto the €49 stage, which got me a free bag and some stickers as well, but I won't be putting the stickers on, sorry chaps. But they made me pay €61. I couldn't work that out. Maybe I've missed something with Kickstarter. It could all be me. But anyway, I'm quite happy to pay €61 for it. It looks a really good item. I'm really chuffed that I've got on board. I hope I can get one sooner than February and we can do a proper review so you've all got a chance of getting on. I have written to them and said, guys, can you send us a prototype through so we can have a play, and then we'll do your review of it, and then hopefully we'll get you more people on your Kickstarter. But from what I read, I think they're halfway there already on their Kickstarter funding. So well done to the boys that have come up with that, and girls perhaps. You'll get it in February 2017, but I've signed up for it. It's the AER GoPro. There you go, for your GoPro. This young lady is Louise Delange. She's a French socialite, or she would be if she was even remotely real, because she's not. She's completely fake. She is the figment of a Paris agency called BETC, and they were trying to raise awareness for the risks of alcohol addiction in young people on behalf of a firm called Addict AD. a dictade. The idea is to highlight how easy it is to miss addiction in people that are close to you. So it's a series of pictures of this fictitious French socialite who is out and about doing her thing and having her picture taken and posting it up on Instagram. But the thing that's quite subtle about it is that in every single shot, she's clearly drinking. There is a glass of wine or something in her hand. And they got a good response to it. They had 50,000 likes within 149 posts of posting and 500,000 views in total in a two-month period. So lots of people like this. Why did so many people like it so quickly? Well, it's shown quite an exotic lifestyle for a start. It's shown a very pretty French model, who I presume is French, but she's a pretty girl, who shows a bit of cleavage and is living a lifestyle that most people would aspire to. So I can see that you get a lot of people very quickly into it. So if that's what they intended, well done. They then outed the real thing. They then said on the Instagram account, this is the way that it is. And they said that the response was huge and that people were shocked at how they hadn't noticed the glass of wine in the hand and the addiction to alcohol. Well done. I don't... But, I mean, it's social media. It's not real life. You know, you need to look at everything that you see on Twitter or any kind of social media and take it with a pinch of salt. You need to listen to these shows and sit and think, does Ewan really mean that? Because in a lot of cases, I really don't. I'm just saying it for the laugh. You know, it's only a bit of fun. And as far as that addiction to alcohol goes, well, I'm the last person you should talk to, shouldn't I? Now then, have you ever done one of those space flight things with a GoPro? I really would love to do them. You stick on a weather balloon and you throw them up in the air and you see all the pictures that you get. Well, a guy called Brian Chan did this in 2013. This is him and his mates. They are out in the middle of the desert in Arizona and they are putting up a weather balloon so that they can get some great pictures of the surrounding countryside and maybe take other measurements, I don't know. It was part of a college thing that Brian did with his mates. And you're sitting thinking, well, that's irresponsible, isn't it? No, it's not. They did all the right things. They went and got permission from people. They went to the aviation permission authorities and they got permissions for that kind of stuff. And they launched the balloon in 2013. Why are you covering a story in 2013, Ewan? Well, the problem was that it went a lot higher than they thought. They actually got the balloon to reach nearly 100,000 feet. And then when the balloon burst and it started to descend, it actually landed 50 miles from where they were expecting it to. And it was out of cell tower range, so the information that was coming back to them about the GPS location wasn't getting to them. So why are you still covering a 2013 story? Well, it's because it's been found a few weeks ago. A woman who was out hiking has walked across and found the custom rig. This is the rig that they made, which is pretty impressive. It's 3D printed and it's got a nice frame and it looks absolutely brilliant. And she's returned it back to them because their name was in it, obviously. And the cell phone and everything, they've got a whole lot back. Well done, lady that found it. And then they opened it up and they had a look. And they have got possibly the best picture of the Grand Canyon ever taken. This is the picture and it is an absolutely incredible image. They could have done with balancing the levels on it, but what a great shot. And that's a slightly wider view of it. A mile deep into the Earth's crust. There you go, the Grand Canyon. Shot by Brian Chan and his mates. And there's a couple of stories, one on Pop Photo and one on Petapixel, if you want to go and have a look. And there's a video of it on the Petapixel one, which is absolutely sublime. It is a beautiful, beautiful video. They put some nice music behind it. And it kind of pulls you away, if you like, on a tide. Very, very good. Excellent, excellent, excellent. Probably can chuck live models now. Are you mixing up the two stories there, Bronwyn, perhaps? Yeah. She put a link in there about a story that she's seen that really fascinated her. But I'll have to click that one. Maybe we'll stick it in next week, perhaps. Well done, Brian. Now then, have you ever wondered, could you get a super tanker in the lake in Central Park? Well, yes, you can. And you go, blimey hell, how are they going to get that out? Well, it's not real, okay? So this is a project that's been done by quite an inventive chap, actually, Kevin Wisbeth. He's a college student, and he's creator of a YouTube channel called A Quick Perspective. And his idea is to challenge your view of the world about size and the economies of scale, if you like, of certain items. So that is what a supertanker would look like if it was in the lake at Central Park. And there's not an awful lot of room to spare. And actually, if you imagine tilting this thing upon its end, this thing is longer than all of the buildings that are around it in the whole of New York there. So these are long structures. Did you know you can get a NASA M1 rocket and you can put your smart car in it? It's that big. It's a garage for your smart car, Nay, and there'd be 2 foot either side to spare on it. Brilliant. And again, that's Kevin's visualization of it. I think it's a really good idea because a lot of people don't get the idea of how big certain things are in terms of engineering. If you live in Chicago, you'll be familiar with the Sears Tower. Well, the Sears Tower fits with room to spare in the world's largest open cast quarry mine that's down in Russia. There you go. And there's a picture. And the thing I like about what Kevin's done is he's actually got the lighting right. So this thing looks in the right place. You can tell it's not real, don't get me wrong. But he's got shadows right. He's done the lighting. He's done a really, really good job on the Photoshop of these items. And they look great. The Sears Tower one inside the mine just blew my mind. God knows. I mean, you look at that and you think that's a steep old slope there. They can't have a road. You can't even pick out a road. But I'm sure there is to the way to the bottom. Did you know as well, because we had an oxygen-rich environment in prehistoric times, scorpions were the size of cats. And there's a rather large scorpion next to a pile of cats who are eating some biscuits. And again, well done, Kevin. It's a really, really good use of the light. This one's a little bit harder to see. You'll have to pick it out. But that is the space telescope in Guizhou in China. It's 1,600 feet across. And there's a picture of it on the strip in Las Vegas. And it's massive. It really is massive. You can fit one of the hotels underneath it. It's that big. And then the last few here, this is a B-52 bomber in the Indianapolis Colts football stadium. It is wider than the width of the pitch. And again, he's done a really good job on the light on that. I quite like that. This one I love. This is the Titanic on top of the USS Ronald Reagan aircraft carrier. And it's sitting there and there's like 100 feet to spare or something either side of it. It's massive. I couldn't get over that. That really is huge. And the last one is the Dionysus asteroid from the Apollo asteroid belt. This is still out in the Apollo asteroid belt. I hope it's never come in here. This thing is 1.5 kilometers wide, and it's wider than the span of the towers on the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. And again, Kevin's done a great job with the light there, just darkening the sea underneath where it's suspended. That's huge. They reckon that's got something like $450 trillion dollars worth of natural resources on it that we could have in on the planet if we could get out there and if we could mine it. Fair enough. Well done. Some good stories. A bit weak on the news today. I thought I have to. There's not been a lot going on since Photokina. It all kind of just dropped down a bit. But we've got some gear. Don't worry about that. Here's the gear. Now then, do you know the name Samyang, right? Because you bloody should. This is my Samyang lens here. I've got an 8mm Samyang lens in a Sony E-Fit, and it fits onto my FS5 beautifully. It also fits onto my Sony DSLR. And I was blown away when I got this. I've never heard of them before I bought it, and well, I had heard of them, but I'd never got thought about buying one. And I thought, I'll give it a go, because I want an 8mm for doing maybe something, you know, when I get stuck in tunnels and stuff like that, something that's wider angle, maybe have a go at shooting some sky stuff with it, some telescopy type stuff, or, Milky Way type photography. And I bought it, and it's great. It's a fantastic lens. I was blown away by the quality of the build. It is absolutely superb, and it's not expensive. This 8mm lens cost me £230. Brand new off Amazon. It's superb. It's excellent. They make really good quality stuff, but it's all manual. That's the problem with it. So you get it, you know, if you're still shooting well on manual, which I'm not because of my glasses and my bad eyesight, but if you're shooting well on manual, they've got some great lenses out there that won't break the bank that really do the job. But they are coming out with autofocus lenses. That's the really big news, and that is massive news. It depends on the price they're going to come out at, don't get me wrong, but they're bringing out Nikon and Canon autofocus lenses very soon. No date, but very soon. At the moment, they've got two Sony FE lenses which are in autofocus, and the head of production, Zhongmin Shin, has said that there are going to be Canon and Nikon auto lenses. They're already in the works, they're just waiting for them to be released. The Sony FE ones are in the 50mm 1.4 and the 14mm 2.8. So in the way that he said that these are in the works, I got the impression, reading between the lines, that these lenses are the same ones that are coming out in the Canon, and they're just putting mounts on the end of them. So it's identical lens, but with mount changes. So you're not going to get anything different. It's still going to be the 14mm and the 50mm. 1.4 and 2.8. He's also said that they, as a company, they do believe in Micro Four Thirds, but it's not a priority at the moment. So again, you're probably going to get these two lenses when they get to it, but they're a way down the line if you're a Micro Four Thirds shooter. But if you shoot Canon or Nikon, well done, you're going to get this. Aura have resurrected the photo frame. Do you remember these? I had a couple of these things, but like everyone else, they got thrown away because they crapped out. The format was wrong. They couldn't do progressive JPEG. It had to go back to basic JPEG, and give over. I can't be bothered anymore. And to be honest, as well, it was like a race to the bottom, wasn't it? Because it was like a typical fad thing. Everyone made these as cheap as they possibly could. There was no feature in them at all. They just showed the pictures in rotation, and that was the end of it. And it all went. Well, there's a guy here called Abdur Chowdhury, and he said, hang on, let's make this thing feature rich. Let's do more with the photo frame and see if it'll come back. So what he's done is created a really beautiful 8x12 frame that holds your pictures and images. And one of the other things that was really always bad about photo frames was if you shot the wrong aspect ratio, they had no clue what to do. They'd either zoom in on it and it'd look ridiculous, or they'd leave it open. It got black borders everywhere around it. This thing's more intelligent about resizing your image. It's also a retina display, so you're going to get significantly higher quality than you've ever been used to with these things. And also, if you've got your DSLR and you're shooting at, 3,000 pixels by 2,000 pixels, it's going to be a really good quality to look at. Here's the best bit. It syncs through an app with your smartphone. So, don't take a picture of your girlfriend because it's going to suddenly pop up on your photo frame at home in front of your wife and kids. But I'm sure you're not going to. The face recognition software that's built into the app and the algorithms that they've got for the structure of the image, they're saying that if you take a really horrific picture, it's shaky, it's the wrong thing, it's clearly been taken after because of a laggy shutter or something like that on your cell phone, they reckon the algorithm good enough to sort that out and not send it through for the frame. If you do take a really decent picture, then that picture will be whisked out through the cloud and it will instantly be put into the shuffle of your photo frame back at home. Plain and simple, which I think is a really good idea. You may not want that, don't get me wrong. If you're taking a picture of your lunch or something like that, then yeah, okay, you wouldn't want that at home, but it's at least an idea. And the other thing that you've got is this thing's got a sensor on the front that allows for gesture control. So you can stand in front of the photo frame and you can swipe left and right with your hand and skim through the photos just by a hand gesture, which I think is a really good idea. They still need power, obviously, so you're going to have to link up to power on side, but they have got a way of daisy chaining them together. And if the cords are actually quite nicely done, they look like a woven cord for the power, you can actually daisy chain them together and you can make the cord a feature of the connection of the images. They've really thought about this thing. I think it's really good. Price, $400 when it becomes available. At the moment, it's still only in, they've got some venture capital. They've got $6 million worth of venture capital or something like that. So it's probably going to happen. But they're $400 when they become available. There's a lot of tech going on there. There's a really decent screen. There's an app that you're going to get for free of charge that'll do all your photos and that kind of stuff. I think it's a touch big. I think 300 might have been a good price and let's fly off the shelves. But equally, like he says, you know, it's not a race to the bottom. It's not a fad. This is a feature-rich experience and they've got to sell it on its merits. There's some really good stuff there. There's a video over on the link that I've put in the show notes at auraframes.com. AuraFrames.com. Go over there and watch. He's piqued my interest. Well done. Well done, Abdul. Sony A99 is out there, Mark II. They've released the Mark II at Photokina. It's 42.4 megapixel DSLR. It shoots at 12 frames per second in burst mode. 5-axis stabilization within it, and they're talking 4.5 stops of image stabilization in the body alone. As we said last week, the theoretical limit, though, is 6.5 anyway, isn't it? It shoots 4K video standard. It's also got SLT, which is a single lens translucent mirror. So what it's got is a semi-translucent mirror that sits between the lens and the sensor, which allows for a clearer image, apparently, and far better representation in the eyepiece. The body's 8% smaller than the Mark I, so it's not bad. It looks a lot sexier, I've got to say. The finish on it's very nice. It's got that kind of mottledy leather finish to it. There's also a flop-down screen that goes at the back, and it comes down to shoot so you can have the camera higher. I like the way it does that because that will give you far more ease of use to try and get over the heads of people or something like that and still see what you're shooting. I think it's a really good job. The only thing I like, I'm not so sure about with that, is I think it could be a little bit flimsy and you could end up snapping it off quite easily in the way that it comes down. I prefer the stuff that's represented at the back of the camera. And when you fold it down as well, there's just this big ugly space there that I don't know what it actually does. It might do something. I don't know, but it doesn't look like it does. 100 to 25, 600 ISO. That's pretty standard, I guess. Maybe a bit low on that side for the high end. But Sony have done low light very well, so I'm surprised they didn't push that a little bit further. 79 points of focus. It's got a mechanical shutter. The old one was 200,000 actuations was the guarantee on it. This one's got 300,000 actuations on it. So at 300,000 actuations, you're probably looking at the pro end, most definitely, not even the semi-pro end. It's 42 full res images at 12 frames per second in a continuous mode of shot. And the price, it's going to be about £3,000 when it ships next month. And I'm not convinced at that price. It's probably about right, maybe just a touch high. But Sony at the moment have got a real problem, I think, with pricing. The stuff that they've got out there, I know there's a bit of Brexit bendover going on in the UK, but I think all of their stuff is a little bit overpriced at the moment. Sorry, Sony. I know you've had troubles with stuff being washed away in the earthquake and that kind of stuff, but this is not, all these stuff is not really as priced as keenly as it could be. That little thing on the front that you can see there's a little dial on the front. That's actually called a silent multi-controller. And from that single rotational wheel there that will be operated by your right hand, depending on how you hold the lens or your right thumb, your left hand or your left thumb rather, allows you to quickly control aperture, shutter speed and ISO, depending on how you rotate it and snap it. It's a good camera, don't get me wrong. I'm sure it takes fantastic pictures, and if you've got alpha mount lenses, it could be a really good buy, but at 3K, that's an expensive camera. It's an expensive camera, plain and simple. Do you like Manfrotto? Because I do. All of my tripods are Manfrotto, and I do find them very reliable, and I've never had one break on me. This is the Be Free Live video tripod. It's compact and very light. This thing only weighs about 1.5 kilos, just over. It supposedly can hold stably up to 4 kilos, and it has quite a wide-looking base from the opening out. It closes down to 40 centimetres, which is brilliant. I mean, that's a really small fold-down tripod, and it opens up to 151 centimetres, so you're just at the sort of 5-foot mark for your camera body. It's got the standard clutch plate and slider that you get on video tripods, and it's got a nice little video arm that's really been... It looks quite compact, it's well thought out if you like, but still good. And it allows you to do, it's not a gripped panning head, it's not something that's going to be ultra, ultra smooth, I don't suggest, but it's £85, which is good. And a lot of the Manfrotto stuff, if you look at the tripods, they're really good quality builds. They're not cheap rubbish. If you wanted something that was for a light camera to take away, the weight and the size that this goes down to, I think this would be a good little holiday tripod, most definitely. If you like street photography or something like that and you want to carry a tripod around with you, again, it's very, very compact. Knowing Manfrotto, it probably comes with a bag with a carrying handle so you can sling it across your back dead easily as well. Or maybe even just stick it in the pouch of your bag, depending on what type of bag you got. Would I buy one? I don't have anything that I do at the moment that needs me to have a light tripod, and I'm certainly not going to be sticking a $3,000 to $5,000 camera on top of it. It's not built for that, and I shouldn't expect it to deal with that. If you're a hobbyist and you go out regularly into the countryside and you just want something that's stable to shoot some video, then go for it. Start chicking a 400mm lens on this and expecting it to stay stable in a high wind, and I think you're really expecting too much of it. But as something that's quick and easy and light, I think it's a good job. And at £85, it's not going to break the bank. Do you own a Phase 1 camera? Chances are, if you do, you're probably not listening to this podcast. This is going to cost you between £28,000 and £30,000, and it's not new. Okay, the Phase 1 camera's been out for a while. This is the IQ3 medium format camera, and it's the first medium format camera that has been given an electronic shutter. There is a firmware update for it, which allows you to have this electronic shutter function if you buy the back for it. The back comes and you clip it on, and then you have your electronic shutter function. There's also a firmware update that gives you through the lens metering for integration with flash and gives you a preview of how that flash is going to work. It's a 100 megapixel camera as well, and it's got air remote capability now thanks to the firmware update. There's a new grip handle as well that you can get. You can see it there just on the right. Isn't that gorgeous? And that handle is going to cost you £1,500. Oh dear. Yes. Nice camera, but I spend money on cameras quite happily, but I'm not spending £30,000 on a camera. Mm-mm, not happening. Wife would kill me, Jesus. Time for your questions. Yes, come on, send them in. So, questions this week. Ian Lewis has fielded the first question. If you don't know Ian's work, you should. Follow him at Ian L Photography on Twitter. He's in our Slack room as well. And he's one of the most talented landscape photographers I've seen in a very long time. I really rate his work. And we've had a question in from Jufo Jim, who says, what's the best way to get correct exposure on a bright sky, landscape, trees, buildings, etc., when they're in shadow? So Ian's written the answer for this, and I'm quoting Ian. So if you've got any technical issues with it, write to Ian. Don't write to me and complain. Okay? First thing, he said there's several options. Unfortunately, at the moment, digital cameras aren't as good as the human eye and can't capture the same dynamic range that our eyes are constantly adjusting to. So here's some options to overcome it, says Ian. Exposure to the left. This refers to the histogram that you've got and the mountain range that you push. Try and bunch it over to the left where the dark or black areas are recorded. This avoids overexposing the highlights, white areas of the image, and then when you're shooting in RAW, you can to a degree recover the shadow areas by lifting the exposure and maintaining the whites. You'd achieve this in camera by exposing for the brighter areas of the image, and the downside is that this is the limit to which you can lift the image before the blacks break up and you get digital noise within them. Second point, use a neutral density graduated filter. These are filters that are clear at the bottom and dark at the top with a gradual shift from dark to clear. They're placed in front of the lens and allow you to hold back the highlights such as the sky whilst correctly exposing the foreground. The downside to a graduated filter is an object building tree sticking up into it takes part of the underexposure and it could look a bit different. The other thing that I can say to you there as well is if you want to go back to when I was 17, I couldn't afford lenses particularly at the time and I used to use a set of tights for a graduated filter. Go and buy yourself some varying denier tights from the haberdashers and chop them up and then tie them round your lens and vary where they are. Now, if you've got a lens hood, you'll have to take your lens hood off because they've got to go right back to the lens to be fully out of focus. But go and get yourself different types of denier tights, different levels, 10s, 20s, 40s, 80s, and start putting them over your lens to see what kind of effect you get. And also, if you cut a circular hole in them and then pull them back over your lens, you can create a false vignette as well. These were in the days before Photoshop. Photoshop was a glint in someone's eye at that point when I was doing it. But yeah, use tights. And they're cheap, they're easy. You can replace them. If you get it wrong, you just buy another. You get like 10 pairs of 30 denier tights for £2 down at your local pound store and that kind of thing. So well worth doing. Have a play. Go on, just go and have a play. Go and be a cheap-ass photographer. It's more fun than you know. I challenge Ian, actually. Ian, if you're out there, go buy some tights and have a go at doing it and tell me what you think. Yeah, you work in a supermarket, don't you, sir? well, you don't, but you know what I mean. Point three from Ian. Take multiple exposures. You can do this manually or in camera and have a bracketed exposure. This can be as many as you want, but a good starting point is three. You take one shot for the camera to expose for the scene and then exposures either side of that with the camera's built-in bracketing or exposure compensation. For example, one or two stops down and one or two stops up. This will give you a corrected exposed image, an underexposed image, and an overexposed image. Then using HDR, high dynamic range software, you can blend these things together. The downside to this option is HDR can be a bit of an acquired taste. I like subtle HDR. I've got no problem with that at all. It's when it goes to the extremes of getting all of the stuff in that you possibly can. It's not good. And the fourth point, the last is the most technical, but can give you the most natural results. A luminosity mask. Still using your camera, still using your multiple exposures, you can mask in Photoshop to blend areas of highlight and shadows. This is a technical method, so the link to the tutorials that you've got are here in the show notes. And he's put a link into a YouTube video as well there, and also recommended some reading for the students out there of you, and Wikipedia as well. They're all in the show notes. Go and have a click on those links and have a watch, and you'll find out. Thanks very much for answering that, Ian. As I say, if you want to see Ian's work, Ian is one of the better landscape photographers I've ever seen, so he's well worth passing by. I have one of his calendars here. Question two. This is a good one from Jason. Ewan, great to have the photo show back. Really has been too long. I'm taking your advice and not holding my breath each week. Although I do appreciate how much time it takes to do a show like this, you obviously have little or no preparation for the other shows. He's put a smiley on that, so I'm guessing he's being facetious. No, we don't prepare for the shows. You're absolutely right. I'm usually finding stories 20 seconds before we go live. Hang on. Someone's put something in. I'm planning on buying a new camera, mainly for events and walkabout/street photography. I'm wondering if you're Australian here with walkabout. And keen to go to a full-frame sensor. Until now, I've used a D3300. With a 18 to 55 millimeter lens and a 55 to 200 millimeter lens, but my go-to lens has always been the 55-200. Even in outdoor portraits, I generally prefer to be on the 55 to 200 because I like to be out of range and get some more candid shots. So my dream camera would be the D750. You're talking about Nikon as well, which is never a good start because I'm a Canon man, but okay, I'll take your word for it. I really appreciate the low light capability that's in it. For lenses, I'd love to buy something that's really good, like a great lens instead of several. And so, what do you think, Chess? My choice is the 85mm 1.4G, and I could extend my budget perhaps and add the 50mm 1.G. What do you think? Well, I don't know Nikon very well. You're going from a D3300, which brand new at the moment is a £289 Nikon camera. So that's at the cheapest end of their range. It's a 24 megapixel camera with 5 frames per second in burst mode. And you'd look at that and go, well, you know, it's a cheap camera. But I'm sorry, the £250 end of the market is not what it was 5 years ago. 5 years ago, that would have been a dog shit camera. Now, I don't think they are. I think they shoot very respectable pictures. So I don't think there's much of an issue. You've got a decent camera there, perhaps. Do you want to change it? Yes, you do. That's fine. So the D750 is going to cost you in the region of £2,200. You're also talking about two lenses there that I've looked at, and the f1.4 85mm is £1,200, and the 1.4, as I recall, is about £600, £700, something like that, although I haven't made a note in the show notes, which I thought I had, actually. So your budget is looking like it's around the sort of £4,000-£4,500 mark. You also don't say whether you're getting rid of the, I mean, the 18-55 is the stock lens that comes with your camera, I'm sure, and it's 3.5-5.6, I think. If you're talking about the Nikon 55-200, that's a decent lens at f4.5-6-5.6. You don't say whether you're getting rid of that or whether you're keeping it or not. Now, the first thing I'm thinking is, you've kind of gone away from what you said in your question there, that your 55-200 was your go-to lens and you liked shooting with that. And if you're going to continue shooting with that, in street photography, from a distance, f4 to f2.8, you're not going to get an awful lot of difference. The thing I would say, though, is that you can get the 70-200 f2.8 from Nikon, and that's only going to break the bank to about £700, and that's going to give you 2.8, which is a lot better in a sudden environment where you want an instant separation between foreground and background with your subjects. As a street photographer, I would have said that would be my lens, because I've got the 70-200 in the Canon, and if I went out anywhere on walking around taking stuff on a photo shoot or a walk, you know, photo walk, I would take the 70-200 because of that ability. It leaves you to that option to stand further back. If you're shooting at distance, the difference between 2.8 and 1.4, you're not going to actually get anything from it. An 85 seems a little bit close to me, because you're not going to use an 85 for landscape. It's too focused in, and it's not focused in enough to take on the 55-200. The other thing you're going to get with the 55-200 is it's going to probably be quite soft at the top end, and if you're using it on a crop frame sensor, you're getting 1.6 times that, so you're actually coming in at nearly 300 millimeters on it, and the top end is soft, so you're only shooting 200 when you've done a quarter turn back. If you go to a full-frame sensor, you're going to get 200, so all of your images are going to be bigger, and because of the upscale in the megapixels, but you're going to see more in what you'd expect to see. There's a lot of bull talked about going to a full-frame sensor. Fill the frame with interest. It doesn't matter whether it's a full-frame or a crop frame. The only thing that you're really getting with full-frame is you're probably getting bigger pixels, so therefore the image quality goes up, as opposed to a sensor which is on a crop frame because of the fact the sensor is physically smaller. And the other thing that you're getting is that when you shoot with a 200mm lens, you're getting a 200mm focal length, whereas actually, if you're shooting with a crop sensor, you're getting a 300mm focal length instead, so effective on the frame. I don't understand your choice going for the 85 to 1.4. If you say you love your 55 to 200, I'd pour my resources into getting a better lens that was a go-to lens myself. And you pay a lot of money to go to f1.4 when actually, okay, you'll notice a big difference in f1.4 to 1.8 if you were 2.8 rather, if you were shooting in a studio and close up to your model. But if you're shooting at a distance, you're not going to see any difference at all with that. And as I say, 85 and 50mm, 50mm is the limit, I would say, on a landscape. You probably want to go back to a 35mm for a landscape photographer, you know, or you'd start stitching images together. 85 is way too focused, I think. What do I know? I don't do landscape. Talk to Ian. He's the one. Question 3. Infinite focus on a DSLR. This is from Rob. Ewan, thanks for picking up the photo show again. I hope with Ian's help you continue to produce the shows. I've got a very simple question. Why, when I'm out shooting the stars, etc., in dark conditions, does my lens appear to focus at a point that effectively feels like it's beyond infinity? And he's put in brackets, I'm well aware that this is not physically possible, but I'm sure you can explain what I mean. I can still shoot in focus eventually, but it seems silly that the lens can't do this for me or tell me when it's at infinite focus. Right. So if you go out and you do astrophotography, you want to take a picture of the Milky Way, and you get your lens, you're in a very dark environment to start with. You've probably got red lights hanging around so that you don't have to expose your Watsit tubes in your eyes and lose all your light sensitivity. So, you know, seeing things is pretty difficult. And on the top, you've got of your lens, here we go, let's use the Samyang one to show and prove it. You've probably got a little infinity symbol. There's one on there. Can I get it in focus? There we go, it's just there. And you're saying, right, well, when I turn this thing and I hit that point, that is my infinite focus. And the first thing, the first temptation is to say, well, is that because of the cheapness of the lens? If I've got a cheap lens, then clearly, you know, it's wrong. The answer's no. It probably isn't that. Because they all do it. You've got to remember that you're shooting in different temperatures. You're shooting a studio, you're short 60 to 70 degrees in a studio. You go out at night and you could be shooting in minus temperatures quite easily as well as. So you've got expansion and contraction of the metals, the carbon, the plastics that you've got in your lens, and not least the glass itself. So to actually have an absolute point at which infinity existed on a lens would be very difficult based on the range of temperatures in which it has to kind of survive. Yep. The other thing is as well that if you've got, I mean, this is a manual lens, so this may be more accurate because of this, but if you're shooting with an autofocus lens, one of the problems that you have is that the motors for autofocus have to operate very quickly, particularly if you're in a sports lens. So they zip very quickly into position. If they were to zip and lock out at infinity every single time, or at super close lens at the front end of the macro end of it, then what you'd be doing is the lens is hitting an end stop. And at the point that the motor is driving through and up to an end stop, it would end up damaging the motor, and replacing the motors in your lenses is friggin' expensive. You'd be talking probably at least half the value of the lens to get a motor replaced, which makes no sense. So the reason that they leave you that extra bit is because of the fact that you don't want the motor hitting the end stop and then braking. So the difference in the cost of your lens would probably be the accuracy of where the infinity symbol is placed in an ambient condition. You buy a cheap lens and they've put it on there roughly in the right position. You buy a really expensive lens, they may have spent more time accurately marking it, like a Zeiss lens, you know. You might think it would be more accurate as the marking, but you're still going to get that ability to focus past. So when you manually turn to your focus point, if you manually go to beyond infinity, it will be beyond infinity because of the end stops for the motors. Plain and simple as that. The way to do it anyways is shoot a picture, turn it back, shoot a picture, turn it back. And then for yourself, maybe, put your own mark on, you know, a bit of Tippex, or because that'll scratch off. Or if you really want to damage your lens, put a physical scratch in the ring so you can see where your infinity point is based on what you've done with it. Some of the cameras are quite good at as well. They give you a focus bar on the bottom that increments as you turn. You'll find that focus bar goes up. I know my Sony does it, and I know that if I turn back to the third focus bar up, that's infinity for me in actual terms. So, I mean, that helps really an awful lot. If you've got a question, then it's dead easy to send it through to us. Just send it to britishtechnetwork@gmail.com, mark the subject photo question, and send us a question. We'll answer it. It's that easy. Anything that you want, stick it in there, and I'll do me best. Am I the guru on photography? No. Do I believe myself to be the best photographer that's ever lived? No. Will I be able to answer every single question that you send me? Hell no. But send them in and we'll find someone who can. There you go. See, I've palmed that one off today, Ian. Ian's done it. See, Ian's competent. I'm not. That's the way it works. British Tech Network is supported by UK2. Please support UK2. We are supported also by Hoyer. And of course, if you're into photography, Hoyer lenses. Wow. They're the place to go for all your filters and all your fronts, definitely. And also for your glasses, because these glasses are Hoyers. We'll be back again next week as normal, most definitely, with your questions, with more gear news and more general photography news. You can follow us on @BritishTech at Twitter. You can follow me, Ewan Rankin, on @EwanRankin on Twitter. And we'll have a show for you. I promise, we're doing our best here. We're doing our best. We should be going for the next few weeks. Probably the half-term week we're going to end up missing because I've probably got a lot of work on that week. So, or I have got a lot of work on that week, so I won't be doing a show then. There you go. See you next week. Thanks for listening.